Now, InfoTrack continues. Once again, here's Chris Whitting.
Over 10,000 community banks in America have closed in the past four decades, resulting in decreased support for local business and less focus on social needs in many communities. InfoTrack reporter Roy Mackey has the story. Roy?
Thank you, Chris. Our guest is Oscar Perry Abello, author of the book, The Banks We Deserve, Reclaiming Community Banking for a Just Economy. Oscar, just to start with a bit of an overview, tell us a bit about the state of community banking today. The consolidation of the banking industry has been dramatic. So how do the numbers of community banks compare to decades past?
40 years ago, we had about 15,600 community banks across the country. Today, we're down to 4,000 community banks. So we've lost about 11,000 community banking institutions. On the credit union side, the numbers are similar. We had around 15,000 credit unions in 1985, and we're down to about 4,600 today.
And just briefly, how do you define a community bank?
Yeah, a community bank is a bank that focuses its work on a single geographic area, or maybe one or maybe two metropolitan areas at most, maybe a few counties if it's a bank that serves rural areas. But the hallmark of a community bank is a bank that's really tied into, and its whole business model depends on, a very specific geographic area that it has to know very well.
What are the key forces that have maybe pushed the decline of these community banks, and what do you see as the most urgent thing to address?
The biggest key force really that has allowed for the decline of the community banks was the gradual washing away of interstate banking restrictions that started in the 1980s. It was kind of a response to a financial crisis that happened at the time, and regulators came to believe that larger banks, banks that operated across state lines, were more stable. And that's not necessarily true, but that's the approach they took. And gradually, states and also the federal government lifted a number of restrictions, previous restrictions on banking across state lines. And that kind of allowed larger banks to start swallowing up the smaller banks.
Oscar, you argue that community banks are essential for tackling major societal challenges like racial injustice and climate change. Can you share maybe a specific example of a community bank or credit union that's doing this well and what makes their approach so effective?
Sure. Just in my own hometown, so I live in New York City, and I'll give you two examples because they're at different scales, but they kind of illustrate the breadth of what's possible. So in the Bronx, there's a bank called Ponce Bank. It was founded in 1960. It's the only Hispanic-led bank in the Bronx. So, you know, it's almost like Spanish is their first language for most of the folks who even work there. And of course, many of the folks who bank there. It's a bank that knows the predominant Hispanic neighborhoods, the predominant Hispanic commercial corridors. It knows them and their businesses that have been successful there, that could be successful there. It knows who lives in those neighborhoods, who shops in those neighborhoods. And it's able to tell when a business owner who, you know, may not have a big credit history, may not have great credit history or any credit history, but it knows the business. The loan officers can visit the business and walk around and see and smell and feel the vibes of the business and know, yes, this is going to be, or this is a successful business that we can invest in as a bank. And Ponce Bank is a $3 billion bank today. It has something around 60,000 depositors. They may sound large, but remember that just the Bronx itself is 1.2, 1.3 million residents. So even a bank of that size is very tiny in terms of the Bronx and New York City. At the other end of the spectrum, there's a tiny credit union in Brooklyn. It's a $50 million asset credit union. So think about it. Ponce Bank is $2 billion, $3 billion. Brooklyn Cooperative Federal Credit Union is a $50 million credit union. But this credit union knows Brooklyn so well. It knows the small business owners in Brooklyn so well. I'm talking about bodega owners, barbershop owners, salon owners, little independent grocery stores. It knows this borough so well that this cooperative does more SBA guaranteed small business loans than Citi, Wells Fargo, and Bank of America combined. You can only really do that if you understand the neighborhoods and who lives in those neighborhoods. And that's the difference between a community bank and a big bank. And that's what's possible for Ponce Bank, which is a Hispanic-led bank in the Bronx, a Brooklyn Cooperative, which is a majority Black, Hispanic, and Asian American credit union in Brooklyn.
One of the things you write about is that community banking's potential is to create a more racially just economy. How can community banks address the barriers that have made access to capital more difficult for many minority groups?
the two institutions I just mentioned, they're both what's known as minority depository institutions. So they're designated by federal regulators as having a membership or a client base that is majority of one racial minority or another. When you look at the overall numbers, though, just on the community banking side, I mentioned there are 4,000 community banks. There are only 120 community banks that are owned or led by communities of color. Out of the 4,600 credit unions, there's only around 600 credit unions that are majority people of color in their membership. And so when you think about it, that's 3% of community banks and 6-ish percent of credit unions that are owned or led by people of color. The future majority population of this country are people of color. And yet, the bank ownership is still astonishingly majority white. Why does that matter? It matters because all of the data that we have still shows that banks tend to do business with people who look like their ownership or leadership. So the fact that 97% of community banks are white owned, it explains why small business loans are easier to get. The data shows small business loans are easier to get if you're white or if you're working in a white neighborhood versus if you're working in a non-white neighborhood. That data is clear, and to me, the explanation for that disparity is the bank ownership themselves and the fact that community banks have always been a major source of capital for small businesses, but the demographics of their ownership explain why some can get easier access to those small business loans than others.
You challenge activists and community leaders to start more community banks or credit unions. What are the biggest obstacles to that?
Some of the biggest obstacles are the startup costs of a bank or a credit union. Most new banks that I've come across take about $25 to $30 million in startup capital. That is a lot of capital if you are not coming from a wealthy community. There are more examples of credit unions starting up in communities of color, especially Black communities. And in the past couple of years, the new credit unions in communities of color that I've come across takes about $1 million in startup capital. And, you know, that's startup capital both to run the bank, pay the staff to get things going. It's startup capital to have a buffer. You know, whether it's a bank or a credit union, like all businesses, it's going to lose money in its first year or 2 or 3 years sometimes. It's going to need a little bit of a buffer to stay in business. And banks are required to keep a little bit extra buffer than most businesses. And so that startup cost can be challenging to raise if you are, especially if you're coming from a low-income, low-wealth community. But there are ways and strategies to deal with that, and that's what I write about in the book.
Your book calls for regulatory reforms to support community banking. If you could propose one or two specific policy changes to level the playing field for community banks versus mega banks, what would they be?
Two things I'll bring up. One is we've got to re-educate ourselves, policymakers, lawmakers, on what federal deposit insurance was supposed to do. Originally, federal deposit insurance was created to support local banks, smaller local banks that had trouble convincing folks to trust them. Even though they were trustworthy, their lending records were just as good as the big banks, but people had this perception that the big banks were safer or that no bank was safer. You know, a lot of folks would just go to the bank and try to withdraw all of their cash because they believed that the bank just wasn't responsible with it. These were crises. They were known as bank runs, right? Everyone runs to the bank and tries to withdraw all their cash. It still happens today. It's very rare, but it does happen. But the federal deposit insurance was supposed to give folks the confidence. And actually, a couple of years ago, when there were a few notable bank failures, Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, First Republic Bank, after those banks failed, most community banks actually gained depositors or held steady. They didn't actually lose depositors. And that's because deposit insurance actually does still provide that trust. The problem is with the insurer, the FDIC itself. The policymakers have long been under the impression that larger banks are more stable and safer, when that is not true. And so they've allowed banks to just merge and acquire each other and just get bigger and bigger and bigger every year. That's a governing approach, a governing philosophy. And in the past, we favored smaller banks versus bigger banks. And today, we favor big banks versus smaller banks. So that's a policy we would need to change, number one. And number two, in North Dakota is the state where community banks have the highest market share out of any state. Banks headquartered in North Dakota still have 85% of the deposits in that state. So it's a state in the U.S. where community banks are still the most dominant. And when I went out to North Dakota to talk to the community banks about how were they able to compete and stay so dominant in their state versus the big banks, because the big banks are around, they're trying to get into North Dakota, but they can't. And the reason those small banks in North Dakota tell me that they are able to compete is because in North Dakota, there's this strange thing called the Bank of North Dakota. It's a state-owned bank that was created in 1919. Because back in 1919, the policymakers realized, you know, talking with the farmers, that the farmers couldn't trust the banks from Chicago or New York. They needed local banks. And one way to strengthen the local banks was to create a state-owned bank that would hold deposits from the state government. And then on the lending side, it would partner with all the little local banks and credit unions across North Dakota. If you have a small business loan in North Dakota, there's like a 50% chance that at least part of your small business loan actually came from the Bank of North Dakota. But you don't know it because the Bank of North Dakota stays behind the scenes and it supports the local lenders, the community banks and credit unions in North Dakota to do the work. There's a specific way, it's called a loan participation, but it's just one of the most common ways that the Bank of North Dakota supports local lenders in North Dakota. So it's kind of interesting, it's kind of a paradox, right? You have a state-owned bank, but everything about that state-owned bank in North Dakota is designed to support local community banks and credit unions all across the state. As a result of that partnership, like I mentioned, community banks have the highest market share in North Dakota versus any other state in the union.
Banks, of course, whether they're large banks or community banks, require consumers to survive. What advice would you give to a consumer who needs to choose between a big bank and a community bank?
My advice is to not just look at the rates. Now, it's true, you might actually get better savings rates or better lending rates from a credit union or a community bank versus a larger bank. And also to not just look at the services. It's true, like the bigger banks have much more profits that they can invest in the technology, and maybe their app is a little bit slicker and faster. These are concerns I don't want to dismiss, but those are things that are easier to change, right? Like technology is something we can help smaller banks or credit unions to work with. What we can't help big banks to do is to get those big banks to know our communities as closely as a community bank or a credit union. And when you're banking with a local bank or a credit union, or at least a smaller credit union, you at least know that you are supporting your neighbors. You're supporting your community, your city. You are part of an ecosystem that built a country. And we forget, you know, we've never done anything big in this country without little banks. We've just sort of forgotten, or maybe we never learned. You know, I never learned in school that it was really smaller community banks that fueled the growth of this country, that financed most of the buildings and most of the communities that we see throughout cities today. These big banks that we have today, they did not exist in this way in the 1980s. Like, they weren't this big. We didn't need these giant mega banks to do big things. We've always done big things with little banks in this country.
Oscar Periabello, the author of the book, The Banks We Deserve. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Roy. Great to be with you.
And for InfoTrack, I'm Roy Mackey.
And that wraps up this week's show. InfoTrack's executive producer is Randy Meyer, and I'm Chris Whitting. We hope you'll be here next week for another edition of InfoTrack.